Welcome back to Restless Viking Radio, the show where I follow questionable roads, meet remarkable people, and occasionally learn something I probably should have known before leaving home. Today's episode picks up right after holding the fire at Chisasibi, where we met Robert, a man who welcomed us to his fire with a generosity that lingered long after the embers cooled. But if the North has a rule, it's this: no two encounters are ever the same. This stretch of road, and the people waiting at the end of it, would prove that. In the last story, Robert showed us one side of Cree hospitality: quiet, grounded, steady. The very next morning, we packed up camp and pointed the convoy toward Long Point, a place that feels like the continent's final punctuation mark. What waited for us there was nothing like the night before. The morning after meeting Robert, we packed up camp and drove north toward Long Point. The quiet grace of the night before still hung with us. The fire, the sausage, the way Robert welcomed us onto the land that didn't owe us anything. I didn't know what to expect next, but I knew enough by now to understand that the Cree weren't one thing. Robert had shown us one side of this place. Whatever came next would be something else entirely. We just arrived at Long Point, one of the northernmost bits of road you can reach in eastern North America. It's where hunting and fishing parties launch out along the coast and travel hundreds of miles across some of the most remote wilderness in North America. It's a quiet, wind-bent end of the line. As we eased our vehicles into makeshift campsites overlooking the water, the low thrum of an engine rolled in, swallowing the silence. Gravel popped, cracked, and shifted. A vehicle was approaching from around a bend. It's always like this up here. You drive for hours without seeing a soul, but the minute you unpack, someone materializes. A truck eased over the hill and slowed. Gray-haired man behind the wheel, someone in a ball cap riding shotgun. No windows rolled down. I raised a hand and stepped a bit closer. For a minute, they just ignored me, staring straight ahead. The driver's window slowly slid down. "How?" said the driver. I winced. "That's not what I said." He smirked. "You always say, how, when you meet Indians." I stared at him, caught between confusion and the suspicion I'd just stepped into a trap. The passenger's grin widened. Both men burst out laughing. I produced something between a crooked smile and "what the hell is happening" eyebrow. The passenger leaned over and added, "The most important question is, did you vote for Trump?" These guys were playing chess while I was still unfolding my camp chair. I scanned for the angle, then slowly said, "Who's Trump?" Silence. Their faces dropped like I unplugged the room. "Wrong answer," the passenger said. He pointed at the driver. "He's the only guy in the village with a Trump mug." The driver stared straight ahead, fighting a smile. I wasn't sure where to take this. Politics was not my lane, not here, and definitely not with two strangers at the northern edge of Quebec. Most Canadians tilt liberal, and I walked into this conversation assuming the Cree were no different. It was a lazy assumption, one that was dead wrong. This guy, it turned out, was a different sort of creature altogether. Then the driver pushed his door open and stepped out with the seriousness that made me wonder if I was about to learn something spiritual. He surveyed our camp, then he fixed me with a steady stare. "You need to understand something," he said. "We outnumber you, 4,000, he looked around at our group, "to 9, so you better watch your step." Now that was my opening. I put on my most cheerful sociopath voice and said, "Actually, there are 10 of us. The one you can't see has a 12-gauge pointed at your Trump mug, waiting for my signal, your move." The passenger broke first, bending over, laughing so hard he nearly dropped his cane. The driver lit up, grinned wide, and thrust his hand out. "I'm George," he said, "with white hair." I shook his hand. "White hair?" "Yeah, I'm the only bastard of my people who has white hair." I studied it for a second, white as winter. Unusual enough that he'd made it his identifier. "You sure you don't have some English blood in you?" I asked. He considered this with a mock seriousness. "That's probably it." The teasing clicked into place. It was familiar, old-school humor. A little verbal sparring to make sure you were human. Out here, it was social currency, a way to meet in the middle without declaring that's what you were doing. A few teammates wandered over. I turned to George. "Do you know how we can get permission to camp here?" He gave me a number, surprised when I said we had no cell service. "Why the hell do you want to camp here?" he asked. We volleyed why and why not until I explained our goal of reaching Cape Jones. That stopped him. "Really?" I nodded. "Yeah, my dad worked at remote radar sites in the 50s and 60s. I'd been hearing about these stories, these places my entire life. Remote radar sites, military outposts you could reach only by air, landscapes that could swallow you whole. This was my chance to see what he'd seen, to walk where he'd walked. I didn't say that part out loud, though. Really? He asked again, now fully animated. That was the spark for an hour-long conversation. Cape Jones, helicopter flights to his camp up the coast, caribou migration, the land, the people. George was the kind of man who read the land like a textbook and argued with a corporation like it was a moral obligation. And he had argued with a corporation. He'd worked with Dr. Fred Short, a researcher from the University of New Hampshire who'd spent his career studying seagrass around the world. Together, they documented something troubling. The eelgrass beds along the Chesapeake coast were disappearing. Not thinning, disappearing. And with them, the geese. And George had a theory. Hydro-Quebec had been diverting rivers upstream for decades, massive infrastructure projects that rerouted fresh water away from the coast. The fresh water used to mix with the salt water and create the right conditions for eelgrass. Without it, the salinity changed. The eelgrass died, and the geese left. Hydro-Quebec blamed disease, climate change, natural cycles. But George didn't buy it. He had the data. And he had the fire of a man who intends to hold someone accountable even if he has to drag them there. Nelson, the passenger, was his counterweight. Leaning on a cane, tossing in jokes to keep the conversation from buckling under its own weight. A classic sidekick with perfect timing. Eventually, a young couple pulled in, and they chatted with George and headed off along the coast. George watched them go, then turned to us. Well, we should get going. We wished them well, and he and Nelson drove off, the Crusader and the Comic, rolling back into the north. Permission or not, George figured camping there would be fine, and that was good enough for us. We'd driven 1,300 miles with kayaks, and it was time to put them in the water. The inlet looked calm, so the kayakers geared up while the overlanders explored and snapped photos. We launched inside the breakwall, rounding it just as the wind sharpened. Outside, the bay got restless, waves slapped the hulls, and spray washed over our deck. But we kept pushing toward the rocky islands half a mile out. Then we reached a windswept island and landed on the sheltered side. The tide was already sliding out. We walked across the shaved grass, the wind howling through it like an old pipe organ. I stopped at one point, pulled out my phone, and filmed a quick, "Hey kids, guess where we are?" video. Turns out we crossed into Nunavut, carved from the Northwest Territories in 1999. One of those quiet milestones you don't set out to earn but keep forever. Very few people have ever set foot there. Nunavut is bigger than Western Europe, yet fewer than 40,000 people call it home. Out here, distance isn't something you measure. It's something you carry. We'd joined a rare club. The island held a few tough plants and some old hunting blinds carved into the ground. We explored, then paddled back through the chop and drifted into a slow, satisfying evening. Camp chairs, laughter, and the low hum of tired contentment. The northern lights teased us with faint gray ribbons before disappearing. By 1 a.m., we gave up and crawled into our tents. It was Sunday, a day of rest, and we honored it. Tomorrow was Monday. We'd head back to town and try to find a guide for Cape Jones. We didn't know if we'd be welcomed or turned away, but our intentions were good. Sometimes that's enough. As the tide slipped out to sea, we fell asleep under a pale northern sky, grateful, tired, and exactly where we were supposed to be. Long Point wasn't just another dot in the map. It was a reminder that the North has its own rhythm, its own tests, its own jokes, and its own way of deciding when to let you in. Next time we head back to town to search for a guide to Cape Jones and find out whether the door to the end of the continent is open. It turns out we were about to meet the whole town at once. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, stay stubborn, and keep your eyes on the horizon.